Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter. I'm Ray Bohax, your humble host, and I am coming to you, as I always say each week, from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey. So hopefully today is finding things going well for you. It's raining here, and we had a couple of real nice days, and now it looks like we're going backwards a little bit. It's going to be, I think, 36 degrees tomorrow night, and so that's not too good at this particular point. It's only about 51 degrees right now as I'm recording this. So for anybody who has some seed in the ground, and I don't know of much seed in the ground in my neck of the woods, that you don't have too many heat units coming there, buddy. So we'll see what happens. But I was able to get out into the field yesterday, and I did spread off some gypsum, 21% calcium palletized gypsum. I think it had 16% sulfur, and I wanted to get my magnesium calcium ratio in base saturation tilted more towards the cal instead of the mag. And so I put 150 pounds per acre, as I said, down, and I spread that off yesterday. It was dry. The field was a little bit damp, but it was fine. I didn't even stick to the tires, but my cover crop is still down, so I put, and that helped a lot. So I think coming this week, I'm going to have to kill off at least one of the fields with my kill off the cover crop on that. And then hopefully, God willing, maybe by the 10th of May, I could get some seed in the ground. And since I do fresh market sweet corn, we put like 10 plantings in. So if I start late, I end late, and then I do not catch those longer days, then it becomes a problem. So I'm going to change some stuff around a little bit this year. I'm going to plant the field not in a different direction, but I usually start my fields and I work myself over. So I start on the left-hand side and do a planting, and then wait till that pops up for 4 or 5 days and do another one, and then do another one. So I'm going to go from right to left instead of from left to right this year. And the reason being is I have a tree line there. And when the days get shorter, that corn doesn't get that much sun. Or when I get over to the end plantings on each field. So I'm going to have that plant that first so it gets the most sun. And then also, last year we had a lot of problems with coons. And what I found with them is that if the corn is ripe by the wood line, by the woods, that they'll come in and start to eat it, and they'll know it's there, and they'll work through each successive planting. Whereas, so I'm going to use the logic and try to outsmart them and have the area of the field that they would come into be the youngest, so that they will not see that there's any corn, and hopefully they won't realize that on the other side of the field where there's no woods that there is plenty of corn. So I'll let you know how that works out. Also, yesterday, just before I started to go into the field to spread my gypsum, I always pronounce it incorrectly, I received a delivery from Ford Motor Company of a gorgeous 2019 F-150 Super Crew Limited. So that is going to be, I'm excited, that's going to be the first of hopefully many vehicles that I road test for the Farm Machinery Digest and Idle Chatter podcast. And what I'm basically going to do, I was thinking about it, I was originally going to integrate the road test of the vehicle. I'm going to have an actual magazine-style article on the website for each vehicle I road test, and then I was going to do an overview of that in my podcast, in my show. And then I realized that I couldn't do the vehicle justice, or you, the farmer, justice discussing it by just putting a few minutes into the show. And historically, I go an hour on the show, and I really don't want to push it much longer than that. Sometimes with the intro and the exit music, it goes to be an hour, 1 minute, or an hour and 2 minutes. And I don't think that you have much of a threshold to listen to me beyond that. So what I said to myself, I was thinking about it, and I said, geez, you know, why don't I just do a dedicated road test podcast for each vehicle that I get? So that's what we are going to do. And I'm excited about that. I'm going to put this truck tomorrow on going down to South of Jersey, to that neck of the woods. And my friend has a shop down there, Ida Automotive, and part of each road test is going to be a chassis dyno test. So this way we could see exactly how much power is getting to the wheels on each vehicle. So we're going to do a lot of testing. It's going to be a very, very, for lack of better terms, professional type of road test with instrumented numbers, fuel economy, and sound decibel readings. But I'm also, the whole purpose of this being that there's no place that people in agriculture could go to have one of their peers road test a vehicle. So if you look in the mainstream magazines, Motor Trend, Car and Driver, where they have some of these websites, and, you know, Truck Trends or something like that, and they don't test the vehicle. They don't look at the vehicle through the eyes of somebody who's truly using it every day in an agricultural venue. I mean, they look at it as a town guy or a city guy driving a pickup truck. And I'm not going to limit this just to pickup trucks. I'm going to also do vans, and I will also do vehicles that will that the farm family would be using. For instance, like an SUV or a sedan. And I'm going to look through it in the eyes, through the eyes of a farmer. So if you have a sedan or an SUV and it's very low slung for that aggressive look, that's really not going to get you down a pothole dirt road in Nebraska. So, or if your wife wants to come visit you in the field and bring you some lunch, she's going to need some ground clearance there. So I'm going to, it's going to be a little bit different, and hopefully you guys like it, and bear with me. I'm going to have to tune it up and tweak it as we go along. But the F-150 Limited Super Crew, and what's interesting about that truck, it's a gorgeous truck. It's the window sticker is $74,000 on it, but it has the Raptor engine. So it has the 450 horsepower EcoBoost versus a regular F-150 would have a 375 horsepower EcoBoost. So I'm really interested to see what she does. All I did was take it to town yesterday to take my wife to the library, and then I wanted to get on the tractor and spread off some of that gypsum because it was supposed to rain later in the afternoon, and I did just catch a couple of raindrops as I was finishing, and so that worked out pretty well, thank God. But the truck is gorgeous, a lot of buttons inside, let me tell you that. It looks like the space shuttle, and I'm going to have to figure that all out before I leave at 5 o'clock in the morning to go down to South Jersey tomorrow. But what today's show is going to be about, you know, I was thinking about, you know, all that flooding that happened and probably is still going on. You know, it seems that in today's world, things come and go out of the news cycle, and there is always something to supplant what happened yesterday. And, you know, the world forgets about it. I'm just as guilty as anyone else. And, you know, when something is in front of you, you think about it, and then as the next tragedy or event comes up, you forget all about it. But obviously those people that are living it did not forget about it because it's in their day-to-day life. So what I started to think about is that the marketplace is going to be flooded, no pun intended, with a lot of flood vehicles. And as time goes on. And, you know, the marketplace, I'll use that word because I don't want to, you know, say insurance companies or dealerships or what have you, or unscrupulous business people. But they take it, you know, they're willing to wait for their money. So they take advantage of buying flood-damaged vehicles and equipment, and they know that people in a few months' time will forget all about that, and specifically if they move that vehicle or piece of equipment to a different geographic region of the country. So, for instance, let's say that somebody buys from an insurance company a flood pickup truck. What I mean by a pickup truck that was in a flood damage, we'll call it, right? A flood damage pickup truck. And they take that and then they ship it to upstate New York from Nebraska. And it's 3 months after the flood, or 2 months after the flood. The likelihood of someone from upstate New York or from North Carolina or from Maine or from Pennsylvania of associating that vehicle with the flood that happened 2 or 3, 4 months prior to that is minimal. And they usually, those vehicles and that equipment are usually moved, as I said, to a different locale. And then the idea that it was flood damage, I mean, if you take a pickup truck like that and you send it to New Mexico, people are not used to looking at flood damage there. So it is something that we really need to be aware of. And so what I want to do is I want to dedicate today's show, and it's multi-purposeful. I want to talk about flood damage vehicles and equipment, and because, you know, specifically on this talk, it makes no difference whether it's a combine or whether it's a pickup truck. Because the farmer has everything. The farmer has a pickup truck. He has a family car. He has a UTV. He has a sprayer. He has dedicated equipment, farm tractor, what have you. And they're all susceptible to flood damage if they've been underwater. So this talk today on my show is going to be broad-based. And then what I will do is I will break away into certain areas if it's application-specific, let's say to a car or to a tractor or what have you. But generically, what I'm going to talk about will usually apply to everything. So any type of vehicle or machine that would have been underwater. Now, there is a blessing as far as the floods are concerned, out in the Midwest, and it's, and I just mean that as far as the vehicles are concerned, is that because it was not salt water. Salt water is very, very corrosive, as you would know. So any time that something is flooded with seawater, as they had down in Louisiana years ago with Hurricane Katrina, or they have in Florida, lots of times where the sea comes inland and floods everything, and then the water recedes back out, but everything is covered with salt water, is that that's much more damaging. It's much more of an issue than the freshwater flooding that we had in the Corn Belt of the United States. They're both not good, but seawater is definitely much more destructive. So we can, I guess, in a small way, we could count our blessings that it was freshwater flooding and not seawater flooding. So what I think would be the most prudent thing for me to do is to probably break this down, this show, into two distinct categories. And the first category being how you should deal with or think of or look at, because it's all basically comes into that one same fold, of equipment that you already own that has been underwater to a certain extent. And then the second part, as I get near to closing the show today, before we do our special delivery segment, the second part of the show, I will talk about what to look for when you are purchasing used equipment. And with today, there's such a proliferation of purchases made through the internet and also through auctions. And when you go to an auction, in some instances, you may not know the history of that piece of equipment if it was brought to the auction site by somebody that was, like I say, from a different state. And you really need to beware of those specifically moving forward, because you could pay a lot of, you could pay very good money for a piece of equipment that was submerged underwater, and some cleanup work and some other things, and you know, you think you're getting a good bargain, and obviously it is most likely not going to be represented as a flood claimed vehicle or machine. And so we need to be able to, and there are telltale signs and of that, and we will discuss that as the show progresses. But the first thing that I would say to you is that if you had any of your equipment go underwater, and the water now has receded, and depending upon the insurance coverage you had, and the equipment, obviously, it may be replacement value. Maybe it may not even be insured, or the insurance company may say that they're not going to replace it, or what have you. So those areas are really sketchy. And from what I could glean, is that a lot of people are not going to get the good end of the stick on this particular deal. But let's just look at it as far as the machinery is concerned. The first thing that you need to realize is that that a piece of machinery, and a modern piece of machinery, has an engine, a transmission, a hydraulic system, and electronics, and along with other subsystems, for instance, like the air conditioner, the heater, the radio would be electronic, the interior of the piece of equipment or the vehicle. Now, obviously, the most susceptible part of that, or the most susceptible area for damage, is a modern piece of equipment with a lot of electronics in it. And as the equipment gets older, and you have an older piece of equipment, it's a lot more forgiving of being underwater because it's more mechanical instead of electrical. So what needs to happen is that you need to be able to try to quantify which pieces of equipment were in the water and how deep that water level was. So let's say arguably you have a combine and the water level got just up to, let's say, halfway up to the front wheels. And then you probably had some hydraulic motors, maybe some drives underneath, or the header itself was underwater. But the majority of that piece of equipment really did not see anything, see any moisture, other than the rainfall. Because the engine is up high, the cab is up high, and what have you. Now, let's say you had a pickup truck parked right next to it, a two-wheel drive pickup truck. Now, with that particular vehicle may have actually seen the water come near the top of the hood. So that's going to be a whole different animal. So the first thing you need to do in your mind is you need to be able to identify how deep the water was that each piece of equipment was exposed to. And then we could look at it from that way, and our approach is going to be based upon that. Now, if there is any possibility that water got into the engine, the most important thing is do not try to start it. And also keep in mind that in most instances, not every instance, more of the damage, flood damage, is done as the water recedes than when that piece of equipment is underwater. Because as the water recedes, we're exposing a lot of oxygen to that moisture, and with the oxygen and the moisture, it is the fertile ground to create rust and corrosion. Whereas when it's completely underwater and submerged and has no oxygen, the amount of rust or corrosion would be very minimal. And in almost every instance, that this piece of equipment, when the water receded, sat there for quite some time, and the water that was inside the engine or the transmission or the electronics had to slowly evaporate out and be exposed to water. In theory, and this is in theory, if you were to submerge something and then take it completely out of water, let's say you submerge an engine that took it completely out of the water and immediately started to eradicate all the moisture from it, the cylinders, the crankcase, the fuel system, then you would have minimal to no damage. So the longer that it sat drying out, for lack of terms, is where the majority of damage took place. But to get back on course here, what you really want to do is you do not want to crank that engine over. If there's any suspicion of that engine ingested some water, and you do not want to turn that starter, that key, and have that starter crank, because you don't want to expose the hydraulic action of a cylinder filled with water to be compressed, because as you know, water, like any fluid, is uncompressible, and you don't want to lock that engine up, and also you don't want to move that water around. So the first thing for you to do is you want to pull a dipstick on that engine, and you want to see if anything looks funny. Does it look murky? Does it look white? Does it is it very high? And that's your first step. Very easy to do. You want to look at all of the fluids, the transmission, hydraulic, power steering, what have you, depending upon the application. So obviously you would be checking different things on a combine than you would on a pickup truck, but ultimately you want to be able to look at any of the fluids and see if there's any telltale signs of water in it. And if there are any telltale signs of water, then you need to drain that fluid out. And you need to drain it out, and you need to change the filters to get that out of there. And then what I would also like for you to do is, while that fluid is being drained and the crankcase is empty, I want you on a gasoline motor to pull the spark plugs. And on a diesel engine, it's a little bit harder to pull the injectors out, but you want to be able to try to crank that engine over by hand with some sort of wrench. On a big diesel, it's harder, but crank that engine over by hand and see if you're going to push any water out of those cylinders. So at this particular point, we have no oil in it. You're not going to hurt anything cranking it over by hand with no oil in it. And you want to push the water out of the cylinders through either the spark plug holes or the injector holes, depending upon the actual design. Another good thing for you to do is to invest a few $100s, and I know it's hard to invest more money when you lost so much during these floods, and I hope that you hear the solemnness in my voice, because this is like a rescue mission. This is not a show that I'm enjoying doing, because this is trying to minimize your loss after a catastrophic, horrific event, and it's not usually what I talk about. I talk about trying to just make your farm more efficient as far as your equipment is concerned, not trying to rescue something. So you could make a minimal investment of a few $100s and get yourself a bore scope, inspection scope, and then you could go in through the spark plug holes, the injector holes, the dipstick hole, what have you, and look around and see if you see anything of any rust forming or what have you. You'd be surprised. You could have some algae forming in there, believe it or not, and or some mold forming, depending upon the application and whether it got any oxygen and whether it was exposed to a lot of sun load afterwards. So you really want to just look around in there and see what the story is. Once you are confident that you have that you got all of the moisture out, if there was even moisture. Now keep in mind, even with something like a pickup truck, that today's engines are very, very well sealed. And if it's a newer engine and it's obviously fuel injected and the throttle body is up high, you could conceivably put that engine underwater up to the valve covers and the dipstick tube, the top of the dipstick tube, can't get my tongue back in my mouth, and put no moisture into that crankcase or into those cylinders. So in an older engine with open breathers, probably not sealed as well as modern engines are, and it sat underwater for a long time, then you would probably have some migration of that into the engine. So don't think, the worst thing you could do is think, because it was underwater or partially underwater, that's junk. And that often is not the case. So it's specifically with freshwater flooding versus seawater flooding. And so once you crank this engine over by hand and you feel confident that it that it feels good when you're cranking it over. You don't feel any binding or what have you. Then you would put oil back in it. Obviously, put the spark plugs or the injectors back in, and you could then give it a whirl with the starter. And you may be surprised she starts. But the thing also, I really should back up, is that there's a very good possibility that you may have gotten some water into the fuel. So before you do start that, I really should have said you have to examine what's happening in the fuel tank. And then again, on a modern vehicle, though we complain about their complexity because of hydrocarbon emissions, evaporative emissions, that the gas tanks on a gasoline engine are sealed very, very well. So they don't have the open vent breathers like we had years ago. So the thing is that it's very possible that you did not get much water or any water at all in the gasoline. But then again, you know, you make that decision. You may want to drain the gas out. That gets to be a little bit of a hassle. If you have a lot of vehicles or engines that you're trying to save, you then again, you know, sore subject. You may want to make a little bit of investment and get, they sell, I think they call them like gas buddies. They almost look like an air conditioner charging station, and you could put a tube from the gas from the fuel tank, fill it down into the tank, and you could suck out all of the old fuel when you suck out the water with it also. And then you could inspect it in a glass jar and see if it separates. And if it is fine, it doesn't have any moisture in it, then obviously you could put that back in. And that would work for gas or diesel. They are quite costly as far as, I mean, they're not $1 million. I mean, a good one may be $1,000 or so, but it is a tool that you could use moving forward after you recuperate from this flooding. It's always good to have in the shop. You got to pull a fuel tank out for some reason. You could suck the fuel out of it. You have to pull something with a hydraulic pump. You could suck the fluid out of it, not the fuel. So in essence, we're going to have to look at each engine, each piece of machinery on a case-by-case example. But once you feel that there's no water in the engine, you have fresh oil in it, there's no water in the cylinders, and there's no water in the fuel, then I would give it a whirl, because at this particular point, you have nothing to lose. So I would give it a whirl, and you may be very well surprised that she may start and run as if nothing ever happened to it. So that is, and hopefully that is the case. Now, stepping back again, probably the most problems you would have with a modern engine, be it gasoline or diesel, is not with the physical components of the engine having been submerged, but the electronics. And as we all know, that electronics you do not like to get wet or be underwater. But keep in mind again, is that if you got the water out of it, the moisture out of it, and it didn't sit too long, then corrosion and other things would not have the ability to take a foothold in it, and that is a positive thing. But now, with the electronics, what you're going to find is that you'll have some sort of controller, an ECU, on, and then you'll have a wiring harness, and you'll have the sensors. Again, you cannot foretell. What you think may have gone bad has not, and what you think was benign to being underwater may have failed. So the alternator being underwater, believe it or not, will probably not have too adverse of an effect to it, because all of the diodes are potted, and if it has internal voltage regulator, that's all potted. And other than having some corrosion possibly form on the connections, that it would probably be all right. But keep in mind that a lot of these parts, a la like the alternator, they have bearings in them. So even though electrical part of the alternator may be fine once it dries out, the bearing does not like to be underwater. And then once you start to spin that, then you start to have a bearing failure. So, and also keep in mind, with underneath the piece of equipment, all of those bearings being underwater may or may not have been affected. But those really are not major issues. It's probably what submarines, no pun intended, a piece of flood equipment is usually not the engine, the transmission, and it's usually on a more modern piece of equipment is the electronics. But we're going to delve into that a little bit more in a couple of minutes. But I'd like to finish up on the driveline. Same thing with the transmission, be it a manual, be it a hydrostatic, or be it a fully automatic, depending upon the application. You want to, a lot of these transmissions, they don't even have dipsticks, so you want to. And that is good in a way, because the only way the water probably would have gotten in would have been through the vent pipe, but you still want to drain that fluid and change the filter and then take a look inside. And most likely, you know, keep in mind that anything that works through a petroleum-based product, motor oil, hydraulic fluid, transmission fluid, those oils are a natural anti-rust or anti-corrosion protector. So if the engine is bathed in oil inside and it still had some oil clinging to it, that's going to act as a protectant against the water coming in and impacting it. It's not going to be 100%, but it's definitely a protector. So anything that is running in some sort of oil-based product is going to probably be less prone to any damage than something like a cylinder wall that really has no oil on it. And there's a term with oil that's called wettability. And that means how long that the oil clings to a part from the piece of equipment. Specifically, it's used for engine oil. So when you were to shut any engine off, that oil is going to start to drain back from all of the internal parts that it comes in contact with. And the oil's ability to stick to that part or drain back slower, not keep a coating on it, is called its wettability. And contrary to what somebody may think, is that synthetic oils have a lower degree of wettability than mineral oils. They slide off the parts quicker. So when you shut an engine off that has synthetic oil in it, those parts actually shed the oil much quicker because of the composition of the synthetic oil, and leave them more to be exposed to moisture and to the atmosphere and the negative aspects of that. And that's why I do not, as an aside again to this, I do not recommend people to use these. I love synthetic oils, but they're low level of wettability for an engine that's not going to be run too often, or a collector car, or a collector tractor, or a piece of equipment that you only use, you know, 1 or 2 days, 3 days out of the year. You're probably better off with a mineral-based oil, or a semi-synthetic, which is a mineral-synthetic blend, because it has a higher degree of wettability, and that oil will cling to those parts for a longer period of time before it completely comes off and allows the ravages of nature, humidity, to get in there and to start to impact them. So, if you have engines that were running synthetic oil in them, they may be have a little bit more, or need a little bit more inspection than the others. We'll leave it at that. You know, this is such a broad-based topic. You know, please forgive me, and I don't feel I have the continuity in this show that I want to, because I want to try to bring it all together and try to give you some pointers to look at. And right now I'll say, please, you know, feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com, and if you have any questions that I did not cover here. So, you know, transmission, manual transmission, same thing. If basically, in essence, if it didn't take a long time for it to dry out and be damp for a long time, then you probably have no damage, or minimal to probably no quantifiable damage. You could drain the fluid on it, and then you could run it and get it hot so it boils off any other residual humidity inside the transmission case, and then you will be fine. And the same thing is with the differentials, that you may find that they're going to be very, very forgiving of anything that any introduction of water, as long as you don't let it sit in there for 6 months. And, you know, likewise with hydraulic motors that are drive motors on some pieces of farm equipment. Now, there are other things that you need to think about. That's like a universal joint or a constant velocity joint on a tractor or a pickup truck or a car. that they're not going to like to be sitting underwater for a long period of time. But, you know, if you need to put a U-joint or a constant velocity joint in something, and that's not certainly not the end of the world. It's not $30,000 like a big diesel engine going into a farm tractor or a combine. So we can certainly live with this. But also, you know, keep in mind that I don't want to downplay this, that you can be able to take this piece of machinery or this pickup truck that was underneath water for 2 weeks and then just drain the oil and do some stuff to it, not have any failures down the road. And historically, when something like this happens, it may run fine, for instance, like a universal joint, and then after 100, 200, 300, 1,000 miles, what have you, the joint starts to fail, or the wheel bearing starts to fail, or the alternator starts to fail, or the power steering pump starts to fail because of it now had some use in its degraded condition. But to me, that's none of that is a deal breaker, because you could fix that very easily, and hopefully it doesn't happen at an inopportune time when you need that vehicle or that piece of equipment. But now, when it comes to electronics and wiring, that's a whole different ballgame. And if you have a lot of electronics that have been underwater, it's basically going to be a crapshoot whether it's going to be affected or not, and then the level of its effect. But predominantly, what you need to realize is that when the moisture will actually, the water will actually sneak in at the connector to the electronic part, whether it's a sensor, whether it's an ECU, a computer, an auto guidance system, and believe it or not, it will start to almost like a capillary action. I don't know if it's truly a capillary action, but almost like a capillary action, and you're keeping it underwater, that water will actually work from that connection, that pin that goes into that piece of electronics, the terminal, and go up in and work itself up into that wiring harness. Now, keep in mind, it is not going to work itself 3 feet up into the wiring harness. All right, so it'll probably work itself up maybe a quarter to a half inch into the wiring harness, and from that point on, it will be 100% fine. Now, you know, the decision needs to be made between you and your insurance company, if you have insurance, and, you know, the best case scenario would be for them to pay you off enough money that you could buy a new piece of equipment. All right, or almost a new piece, or almost pay you enough to buy a new piece of equipment, and you go into your pocket for the rest. But if that is not the case, and you want to try to salvage this piece of equipment, then as far as the wiring harness is concerned, there, and this is where you're going to have to do a lot of research. But basically, let's talk about dedicated farm equipment first, not vehicles. But almost every connector that is used on a modern wiring harness on a TF4 engine or a auto guidance system or what have you has its roots in the auto industry. Because the auto industry was the first ones to bring microprocessor controls to vehicles and to engines. And a lot of those connectors are, probably every type of connector that you would see has its roots in the auto industry, and is usually, if it says PED on it, capital P, capital E, capital D, sometimes they'll have a period between it, which is PD, PED, that's what's called a Packard style connector. And that is a connector that was actually designed and invented by the Packard Electrical Wiring Division of General Motors. And so, and everybody today uses a PED style connector. And that connector actually had a plastic housing. It had a pin terminal that went into, it usually was a male that went into a female, but it could be the other way around, depending upon the design. But historically, the wiring harness had the male on it, and then it had what they call a weather pack, which was a rubber boot behind it. And you need a special tool to release that connector from that plastic, or the wire from that plastic connector. Now, in almost every instance, and the internet is great for this, you could find companies that actually sell those connectors and those ends. Now, most factory wiring harnesses, in most applications, have a little bit of extra length to them. So if you were so inclined that you could probably remove those violated from the moisture connectors, cut them off, you have to buy a Packard-style crimping tool. It's a special tool on the Packard connectors, but this is all readily available, and you could do it one wire at a time and pin that back out. Now, the thing is that I'm not going to deny that this is a labor of love, and this is often very physically challenging due to the contortions that you would need to make to be able to reach those connectors and cut them off and put new connectors in. And the reason why you're cutting them off is because, as I said, you'll have corrosion that'll get in the first 16th of an inch, 8th of an inch of the wire. And beyond that, the wire is totally unviolated. So by cutting off that end and putting a new connector on there, and the only reason why you're putting a new physical pin connector on it is because once those are crimped, you can't take them off and remove them. So they need to be cut off. So it's a one-time use pin on all of those electronic wiring. It's not that you could unsolder it or open up. It's a crimp, and some of them may have a bit of solder on them, but usually they're just a very defined crimp from a dedicated crimping tool. So that is something you could look at. In some applications, specifically more automotive, I know Ford Motor Company is excellent for this. The thing is finding a dealer that knows how to look it up in a book. They would actually sell you pigtails that have maybe 6 or 8 inches of wire on it. They would already be pinned out for that application, so the wire colors would be correct, the pin locations would be correct to go into that control unit, whether it's an engine controller or ABS controller or what have you, and it would, and you'd be able to cut the pigtail off and then just go color to color and then solder the pigtail onto the factory wiring harness that was underwater, didn't affect it, and then shrink to that, and you should be golden as far as that wiring harness is concerned. In some applications, you may be able to buy a new wiring harness, but then I just want to say, I want to say is that the wiring harness itself, you could stick those under the ocean, and it's the ends where it connects into something is where the moisture forms, not in the middle of the wire. And unless that harness was violated for some particular reason, you know, had a chamfer, or a little hole in it from rubbing against something, that wire is benign. It doesn't care that it's underwater. Alrighty? So that's that, and you may also look into a new wiring harness. So you could new wiring harnesses are available, but, you know, it has to be a business decision for you. And all I want to do is give you the technical aspects of this. And on a vehicle that has hydraulic brakes, if you think that if the water got up to the wheels or to the wheel wells, then again, that system is sealed. So you really should not have had any water integrate the brake fluid, but that's easy enough to change on a hydraulic braking system. But then again, keep in mind that those wheel bearings were underwater, and that caliper or those brake shoes were all underwater. And the worst case scenario at that particular point, you would need to take that off and you'll polish them back up, the slides and the calipers, the backing plate and the brake shoes, the cable or whatever, and lubricate it, and you would be good to go. That would be golden. And, you know, we keep coming back to the same thing. At what particular point does this become a restoration? And are you in the restoration business, or you are in the farming business? Are you in the restoration business, or are you in the ranching business? So, you know, everything can be fixed. There's nothing mechanical in life that cannot be fixed. It's just a matter of how much effort, how much time, and how much resources that you want to put into it. So, you know, the insurance company is going to want to try to get it as cheap as possible and give you next to nothing. But that piece of equipment was worth a lot to you because it was running your farm. And, you know, so, you know, always... always use that balance of, is it better for me to get rid of this thing? If you're like me, I hate to say goodbye to things. I fall in love with them. They become part of me. Even if I buy something new, I keep the old one, which is kind of crazy, but a lot of us Falkmans do that. And you keep the old one because it's still good, and you feel guilty about giving it up, and I know all of that. But these decisions need to be made on a case-by-case basis. But I do want to say to you that the electronics has the potential to be the most problematic and the most costly to repair. So, keep that in mind. And also, keep in mind that as you go down the road, no pun intended, you could have something that works fine. Let's say you had an auto steer system or a monitor or something in the cab, what have you, something electronically operated, and then a couple of months from now or down the road, it starts to act up or just do funny things or intermittent things, then what I would basically do is look at the ground circuits. You know, and I preach ground circuits because they're so important on electrical systems, whether it's just a starter motor, a cranking motor on an old mechanical diesel or gasoline engine or a 2019 piece of equipment, whatever the electronic bell and whistle, is that the ground circuits are so important. And what would happen is that over time, because that ground circuit was damp and wet, and as I said, most of the damage occurs as it is drying because it's exposed to heat and a high level of high oxygen content, that ground will be corroded. So if you do have a piece of equipment that was flooded, you got it up and running, it's been running fine, and then down the road it starts to do something funny electrically, then the first place I would go is try to identify where the grounds are for that, and look at those grounds, because you could have a lot of corrosion under that ground, and also you could have corrosion from the eyelet or the connection on that ground up a 16th, an eighth of an inch, a 32nd of an inch, just into that wire. Because remember, is that if you have that eyelet that goes onto those wires, if you have corrosion, just a minute way up from that eyelet, that's just as good as being corroded the whole way, because that is the blockage for the electrons to get to ground. That's like having a plug sink. It makes no difference whether the sink is plugged 2 inches down into the trap or 3 feet after the trap. It's still plugged and it's not letting the water go down. So the thing is that, you know, always keep that in mind, that if a problem pops up down the road and it's electrical and it was a flood vehicle or flood engine or flood piece of equipment, that you need to identify those grounds. And a quick and easy way, obviously you could take them off and study them, but the quick and easy way would be, depending upon where the corrosion is, for you to put a jumper wire to a ground someplace else and see if the system improves. Now keep in mind, as I said a second ago, that if there is corrosion on the inlet or just a small minute amount back into the wiring harness, then running an external ground jumper is going to prove nothing, because the corrosion is before that. So we have, so in essence, basically to recap here before we move on to purchasing a used piece of equipment, is that we have the engines. We want to look in there, we want to determine easily whether there is any water in there, drain the fluids, drain the oil on everything, all right? If you feel that you want to look in there with a borescope, if it's easy enough to do. If it's a nightmare like on a big diesel, you may want to pass on that, but you do want to make sure you don't. The take home message here is that you don't want to turn that engine over with any moisture in it, any water in the oil or in the cylinders, because that is going to cause more problems than the flood. That's be like riding, like getting a flat tire in a car, and instead of just stopping and changing the tire, you keep on riding, driving, and then the tire comes apart, you ruin the rim, that the tire hits the fender and dents it and what have you. So you don't want to crank the engine over, right? You want to check that as far as the drive line is concerned. You want to look for basically a drain and fill is probably all you really need on a differential or a hydraulic system or what have you. And it'll probably be very, very, very forgiving. Because, as I said, it's not salt water, so it doesn't have that corrosive nature that you'd be seeing with ocean flooding. And And then also, you want to you make a mental note of how deep the water got in each piece of equipment. So if it was way below anything of consequence, then probably other than a wheel bearing or something like that being exposed to it, you're good to go. And, you know, keep in mind also that depending upon your insurance policy, and I may be talking out of context here because that's not my expertise, but lots of times they'll pay you for the vehicle or the piece of equipment, and then you could buy it back. So a salvage value. So it may behoove you to get paid for the piece of equipment, buy a newer or brand new piece of equipment to put back into the field, and then buy this back for 5 cents on the dollar because it would be just salvage value. And if it's they would probably mark the title salvage value, but I really don't know if they do that on machinery. On a vehicle, they would call it a salvage title. On a road vehicle, but I don't know whether they would do that on a combine or not. And that may actually be state specific. So even if you're getting all new equipment because your policy is going to cover it, then you still want to keep this in mind that you may want to, you know, as over time, fix that piece of equipment back up and then use it as a backup or use it on a farm, whatever. I mean, second combine, but who can't want that? So that's basically that. Electronics, you want to be probably, if the ECU, some kind of control unit, goes bad from being underwater, then that's obviously going to need to be replaced. But that's a simple plug and play, but historically the wiring harness and the connections at the wiring harness and the grounds are where your problem is going to be. The rest of the wire is completely benign to being underwater, could care less, and it's only at the ends where you would have a problem and at the controller. And then again, you know, you have a lot of sensors, so were they underwater? Well, like I say, at that particular point, you know, it has to be your business decision and your call. So, and don't forget about simple things like constant velocity joints, wheel bearings, chains, let's say chain drives on a combine or into a header or something like that. But I think that you will find that a lot of this stuff is much more forgiving than you may have first thought. And hopefully you didn't get too much of the electronics, as I said, is the least forgiving, but it doesn't mean that they don't forgive at all once they get dried out. So if you have like a potted circuit board, and the good thing about agricultural electronics is they're usually very well potted due to vibration. If you have a potted circuit board and that all dries out and you don't turn the key on, it doesn't short two circuits together to pop like a transistor, there's a very good chance it's not going to have any issue. I mean, because if it's all potted and it's has a lot of, and if the ECU itself is potted, you may not have even gotten any moisture in. You may just have some corrosion at the pins. So, you know, like I say, don't jump the gun on it. I wouldn't be, obviously, this is a lot of work and effort that you wouldn't normally have to have had if the floods didn't come. But in some ways, you may be pleasantly surprised. But what I'd like to talk about, as I said, that's your equipment. And what I think that you need to do with so many people buying equipment over the internet, as I said before, and going to these auctions, you know, and don't feel safe because you live in Arizona and the floods happened in Nebraska. As I said, you know, this industry is known for shipping equipment to different parts of the country, to a different area, because the people will not associate that with the floods or the hurricanes or whatever happened. And that, you know, we had bad flooding here in New Jersey with I forgot what the hurricane was. I should have known. We lost power for 6 days. Well, it wasn't Katrina. I forgot what it was called. Katrina was down south. But anyway, it was some woman's name. But a lot of cars, brand new cars, were completely under seawater, and they took those cars, and you know, unscrupulous people bought them. They bought them with salvage titles, and they retitled them through trickery. And they retitled them through trickery and brought them to another state far away from where the seawater was. And they sold those. And those vehicles have usually been very problematic because a car, so and a la pickup truck, has airbags, has a whole bunch of stuff in it, is a lot more complicated than even the most complicated piece of farm equipment. So if you're going to an auction, and most farmers don't buy pickup trucks or cars at an auction, they buy larger farm equipment. What you need to do is look, obviously, do your due diligence, see if you can find out as much about that piece of equipment as possible, And then what I also suggest for people to do, if you can't find out too much about it, if you're in Alabama and you see, you know, most people who get ready to try to move this damaged equipment or flood equipment are lazy. And you know, that's how the criminals get caught, right? Because they're lazy, they think no one's paying attention. And I'm not calling them criminal, but, you know, if you have a, you're in Alabama, and you're seeing this beautiful combine come to auction, low-hour combine, really nice shape and shiny paint and what have you, and it was bought at a dealer in Nebraska or South Dakota, and then you may be a little more suspicious. You should be a little bit more suspicious of that if its timetable fits in when the flooding occurred. So look for that. Look for if the flood had the potential, combine would probably be hard to get that the cab underwater, but not impossible, depending upon where it was parked when the flood waters rose. But you look for telltale signs. For instance, like in the cab, a lot of musty smell, or sometimes look for a completely new interior. So it would be like having an old pair of shoes, not a shot pair of shoes, but a pair of shoes with some walking on them and brand new shoelaces. So if you see that there's, you know, this thing, wow, it's got a brand new seat, it's got a brand new carpet in it, this pickup truck's got a brand new carpet in it, and then that may be very well be a telltale sign that was flooded and they ripped that out and put a new carpet in it or a new seat in it, what have you. So that's a telltale sign. Look also, visually study the piece of equipment for any high watermark or, you know, an area that seems to have rust or corrosion that normally would not be rusty or corroded. So if you look up underneath it, if you look like into the feeder, sorry, I hit the microphone, into the feeder house, and you see, geez, you know, that usually doesn't have any moisture there or any rust there. You know, you got to play Sherlock Holmes, because there usually will be telltale signs of this and of it being flooded. And then, you know, try to stick your head around there and look to see whether there is a any of the grounds. Lots of times you can't see it, but lots of times you can. You'd be surprised what you could find if you just spend 5 minutes looking. And they look extremely rusty. So, like I say, not to use the same words again, there are telltale signs, if you want to be a detective, that it's been underwater. If you also find that the fluids, most people when they sell something or trade it in or send it to auction are not really good about changing the fluids. So now some people are, but a lot of them aren't. So the thing is that what you want to basically do is you want to look to see, geez, I mean, this guy sent this to auction and he just put all new fluids in it, and he put and it has a dealer service tag with all new fluids on it, or somebody's service tag. We could see the oil looks brand new, everything looks brand new. I mean, if there's no service tag, you pull a dipstick, man, this oil looks like it's got 5 minutes running on it. This hydraulic fluid looks like it's got 5 minutes running on it. I mean, those are little things that should perk your ears up. But the best thing to do is, if you're going to buy something from auction, is that if the auction house can tell you where it originated from and who owned it, then obviously that eliminates a lot of guesswork. Because if you said, well, you know, you're in Indiana and this is an Indiana combine and there was no flooding in Indiana, then you obviously don't have to be concerned with that. But a little bit of Sherlock Holmes connecting a few of the dots, and my contention is that if it does give you an indication of being possibly, you say, hey, you know, I don't know, there's some things about here that I don't like. I don't like these new rugs on the floor, and I don't like this, and I don't like that, and I don't like that it's got a new radio in it. The radio doesn't fit the dashboard properly, and it's not a John Deere radio or not a Case radio, and it's a aftermarket radio, and I know these came with John Deere faceplates on them. So I would probably be suspicious of that, and I would sadly walk away from it, because you don't want to buy a pig in a poke. And you could just have a nightmare, and it could actually drive you out of business. So listen, that's really, you know, do some investigating. Check out your own stuff if it's been underwater. And as I said before, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And now I would like to go to our special delivery. And I'm proud to say to you, now I'm happy, because I really was bothering me talking about all of that damage that was done to so many farmers. So, but special delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag. I was going to say Harvey Firestone. But Firestone Ag is a company that was founded by Harvey Firestone, and he was a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today. And it lives on with their 23-degree tread bar, AD2 technology tires, low pressure tires, minimal soil compaction, and now their new Firestone, the Firestone of replacement tracks for people with track machines. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. We have a letter here that came in and from a gentleman in South Africa. And he says he has a 1975 Dodge D600 rack body truck with a 413 V8. That's a 75, nice truck, and a manual transmission. He said that one of the workers changed the universal joints, and ever since then, the truck seems to have a vibration, a harmonic, he didn't say harmonic, a vibration, at higher speeds, and it's also felt a little bit during acceleration, deacceleration, but basically around what would be the equivalent of 50 miles an hour it starts, and he wanted to know whether I have any ideas about that. I would say yes, I do. If it had no vibration before you took the drive shaft out and it had it afterwards, then either one of two things happened. Whenever you pull a drive shaft out of everything, mark with a paint stick, a paint pen, the yoke position to the shaft, and then the drive shaft's position to the yoke in the differential. And if it has, usually they don't have a yoke in the front of the transmission, usually it slides in. But if it's a two-piece drive shaft, if you mark everything and you put it back in the same spot with the new universal joints, you will have no vibration. Simply put, when you guys change those universal joints, you got that drive shaft out of phase or in the wrong clock position, and that is why it is vibrating. So there's no other reason for it. You didn't change the pinion angle or the transmission angle. And what you may want to do is mark that drive shaft now and change the location, turn it 90 degrees and see what happens. But before you do that, make sure that the rear yoke is not out of phase with the front yoke. Because if you put that in wrong, it will go right in, but you would see that the yokes are out of phase. In other words, the one part of the yoke, you should be able to look at that drive shaft, and however the yoke is on the front, the yoke should be at the same clock angle on the back. And if it's in the wrong clock angle, and doesn't match that in the front, and I'm saying the front because that yoke doesn't come off usually as the rear, that you will put that out of phase and you will have a vibration. So look at that first. If that doesn't work, then what I would do is mark the drive shaft with a paint pen, turn it 90 degrees, recheck, turn it 90 degrees again, recheck, and then go from there, and you will eventually get it back in. It's nothing more complicated than that. So listen, I want to thank you so much again for listening to my, thank you so much for listening to my show, and I greatly appreciate it, and if I can help you in any way, never hesitate to contact me, and I'm sorry that so many people in those flooded areas have to deal with this, and I hope that I was a little bit of help to you, and please know that you're all farmers are in my prayers, farmers and ranchers and agriculture. Know that the hot rod farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.